You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of March 2014 on Monaco 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's show...
You just don't, in the 21st century, behave in 19th century fashion by invading another country on completely trumped-up pretext.
America's top diplomat takes Russia to task after Moscow's invasion of Crimea. Robert Fox of London's Evening Standard and Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, will be here to explain what happens next. Then, later in the show. Luke Bainbridge will be here to discuss his new book, Acid House, The True Story. All that plus an art review with Murray White of the Toronto Star and a check-in with Monocle's man in Budapest, Adam Le Bourg. That is Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, right now. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is James Luckhurst with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. The Russian military has given Ukrainian forces in Crimea until 3 a.m. on Tuesday, GMT, to surrender or face an assault, according to Ukrainian defense sources. The head of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, Alexander Vitko, set the deadline and threatened an attack across Crimea. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov earlier said Russia was responding to ultra-nationalist threats. Western powers have condemned Moscow's decision to send troops as a violation of Ukraine's sovereignty. Analysts are warning that diplomatic and economic sanctions are the tools to hurt Russia, as it risks being ostracized from the international community after its military intervention into neighboring Ukraine, with stocks, bonds and the ruble plunging on Monday as President Vladimir Putin's forces tightened their grip on the Russian-speaking Crimea region. Jeremy Stretch is head of foreign strategy at CIBC.
I think it is a pretty high-stakes game that's being played out here. Clearly, as we've heard over the weekend from Secretary Kerry, the diplomatic benefits that the Russians gained from Sochi seem to be dissipating very quickly. Clearly, I think the Russians do risk being ostracized in the international community were this scenario to accelerate and extend. And so we're already talking about diplomatic sanctions, or maybe potentially economic ones.
The head of the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency, Yukiya Amano, says a landmark nuclear deal between Iran and six world powers is being implemented as planned. However, speaking in Vienna, he warned that much remained to be done to resolve all issues regarding Tehran's atomic activities.
Measures agreed under the joint plan are being implemented as planned. As I told the board, the measures implemented by Iran and the further commitment it has undertaken represent a positive step forward, but much remains to be done to resolve all outstanding issues related to Iran's nuclear program.
Mr. Amano said the IAEA remained 1.6 million euros short of the funds it needed for its extra work in verifying that Iran is living up to its part of the six-month accord reached in November. The first witness at Oscar Pistorius' murder trial has told the court that she heard blood-curdling screams from a woman, followed by gunshots. Taking the stand after the Olympic and Paralympic star pleaded not guilty to murdering his girlfriend, model Reva Steenkamp, Michelle Burger testified she was woken up in the middle of the night by a woman shouting for help. Speaking at times through an interpreter, she spelt out the details of the gunshots she heard.
There were four shots. Could you perhaps give us a demonstration by using bum?
Bang. Bang, bang, bang.
There was a longer pause between number one and two than between number two and three and three and four.
Did that have any effect on you?
It was very traumatic for me. You could hear that it was blood-curdling screams.
Earlier, Asomba Pistorius stood before Judge Tokozile Masipa to plead not guilty to murdering Steenkamp. Two Egyptian police officers have been sentenced to 10 years in prison for torturing an activist to death in 2010 in an incident that became one of the triggers for the uprising that toppled President Hosni Mubarak. Witnesses and rights groups said that 28-year-old Khaled Said died after police dragged him out of an internet cafe in the Mediterranean city of Alexandria and beat him to death. The two officers were sentenced to 7 years in prison in 2011, but a court cancelled the ruling after an appeal and ordered a retrial. An Italian court has sentenced Beppe Grillo, leader of the anti-establishment Five Star Movement, to 4 months in prison for entering part of a sealed-off construction site during a protest against a high-speed train line in 2010. The incident occurred when Grillo and other protesters defied police orders not to enter a mountain hut built on land considered part of the site reserved for construction of a high-speed train line between Lyon in France and Turin in northern Italy. Microsoft founder Bill Gates has regained the top ranking as the world's richest person, according to Forbes magazine's annual survey of global billionaires. Mr. Gates' total net worth was estimated at $76 billion this year, up from $67 last year. The news means Mexican tycoon Carlos Slim has dropped to second place. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James Luckhurst. More news here on Monocle 24 in 24 minutes. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.07 and 13.07 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news is Robert Fox, defence editor of London's Evening Standard newspaper, and Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Welcome both to the programme. Let's turn our focus to the biggest story around, Russia's invasion and control now of Crimea, a southern peninsula belonging to Ukraine. Can you see any master plan that Putin would have here?
Well, Putin's master plan is to call the West's bluff in Ukraine and Eastern Europe. Ever since the early 1990s, Russian elites have feared that should they try and redraw the borders of Europe by force, they would be met with savage economic sanctions. But over the past decade, Putin and his elite have stripped so much money out of Russia and squirreled it away in European tax havens, European properties, and European banks, that they now believe that they've collectively brought Europe's elite and that there is no chance of severe economic sanctions coming from London, Paris, Berlin, Rome, Madrid, because these countries' elites are effectively dependent on oligarch gold in an era of no growth.
Ben Judah, you've written an article recently for Politico with the title Why Russia No Longer Fears the West, and basically it sounds like you summarised your point there already.
Yes. Well, the essence of Russian corruption is the extraction of vast sums of money, billions and billions of dollars, more than $30 to $50 billion annually, out of Russia. They're taken into Western tax havens, Western, European properties, and invested in European shady accounts. And the people doing this, laundering this money, they're not Russian. They're British bankers, they're French accountants, they're German financiers. And this day-to-day experience of Western elites has changed the Putin's impression of the West. If you're one of Putin's henchmen, if you're a member of the Putin cabinet, and when you come to London, you're greeted by British aristocrats trying to sell you flats in Knightsbridge, and then you have lunch with well-educated former MI6 gentlemen who've set up consultancies trying to sell you all kinds of consulting services. And then you go and have drinks with more members of the British establishment and former British prime ministers even who are willing to sell you PR techniques. Why would you respect this elite? You know, Putin thinks he knows Britain's dirty secret and Europe's dirty secret as a whole, which is that we're no longer a moral or a crusading alliance. This is a Western Europe with the morality of a hedge fund. You know, make big profits and take the money offshore.
Robert Fox, what do you think? What is Putin's master plan?
I think he's playing it as he goes. There is a plan. He's thought about it. This didn't just pop up with him out of the blue, as the BBC was reporting, ordering 150,000 military personnel into manoeuvres. Shame on the BBC for reporting it in the way that they did. And I'm very serious about that. This is something you have to plan for at least 3, 4, 5 months in advance. These plans, it'd be very interesting to hear what our colleague has to say about this, and he really does understand this. The way he is using force or projecting force is intelligent, it's cunning, and it's not according to the formula of the Cold War and the immediate post-Cold War. Famously, Stalin said, "How many divisions has the Pope?" The idea that you're putting military presences into the field, but they're not there to fire shots, it is very, very different from the approach, say, in the Prague Spring, when Soviet tanks went into Czechoslovakia. It is what Putin does understand is how to play on irredentist fears. And this is why that they had to go for the Crimean first. You couldn't do Crimea and East Ukraine at the same time. And he's doing it step by step. And obviously, he is testing the reaction now to what has happened in Crimea. There is no visible serious opposition. The rhetoric that is coming from Washington and coming from Brussels is weaker than even Putin could have anticipated. And now he has to say, what next? The thing that he must fear is the markets, because while commentators, not the generality, but quite a number of them were saying, well, of course, he can turn off the gas and that's the way he can screw in every sense Ukraine. Well, that's nonsense, of course, because he also screws himself if he does it for long enough. Look at where Gazprom is today. Look what's happened to the ruble. Look what's happened to the Moscow stock market. And this is why it is very, very delicate. And the problem that worries me, finally, is where Obama and Kerry really are on this. Obama and Putin over the weekend talked for 90 minutes, and we see no product of this. We see no real diplomatic engagement, and there has to be diplomatic engagement. I think, by the way, it's an awful wake-up call to Europe, because Europe must be worried. I mean, Western Europe, that is from the Polish border right through to the North Atlantic, is why America simply does not understand the dynamics of Europe today. And I think that the instruments like the EU, like NATO, have got to get their act together, and they have got to prepare and announce their position within 48 hours.
What we've seen this far, it's quite clear already that Putin has known what kind of a risk he has been taking, and considering what you just said, these plans, planning of them has started 4 or 5 months ago, he must have known what the financial consequences could be as well, just looking at how the ruble has been plunging today. At the same time, according to some sources, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has told Barack Obama that she wasn't quite sure whether the Russian president was in touch with reality. Looking at all of this, how should the West react?
The story of an isolated Putin who is may or may not be in touch with reality is very much the impression that I've got over the past few days from speaking to Russians with sources in the Kremlin and Russian officials willing to talk off the record. Only days before the movement on Crimea, large swathes of the Russian government knew nothing about it. And the story that we're getting from Moscow today is that Putin, in a small group of people, none of which who held vast assets in the West, took this decision and presented it as a fait accompli to a stunned and slightly frightened, elite. And you have in the Russian press, or what remains of the liberal Russian press, a shrill and terrified rhetoric which is coming out. You've had Russia's main liberal newspaper, Vedomosti, calling for the country not to follow the path of Goebbels and Hitler. And you've had Russian state television propelling levels of propaganda that are indeed approaching 1930s levels. For example, you have Russian state television reporting right now that over 600,000 refugees from Ukraine are streaming into Russia. This is simply not true. You have Russian state television speaking about imminent neo-Nazi attacks on ethnic Russians in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine. Again, this is simply not true. And you have reports of spontaneous Russian uprisings in eastern Ukraine, planting the flag over government buildings in Donetsk and Kharkiv and in Odessa. We know that these are not quite what they seem, because the photo of a gentleman raising the flag over Kharkiv, who was sold on Russian media as a local outraged gentleman, actually turned out to be an expert parkour runner from Moscow. There are pictures of him all over the internet raising the flag over different parts of the Kremlin and major Russian buildings. Where will this end? You have a lot of fear in Russia's business community that Putin doesn't quite understand the subtlety of what's going on. Vladimir Putin is, of course, not a trained economist. And when he got to grips with economic issues in the early 2000s, he swallowed two reports whole. What the first report he swallowed whole was the BRICS report, where where Goldman Sachs predicted that Russia, China, India, and Brazil, of course, would just grow forever at a static rate. He was convinced that because Goldman Sachs had told this, it must, of course, be true, and that sooner or later, Russia would be the largest economy in Europe. The other report he swallowed whole was that because China was going to grow forever and at the same rate, oil demand would grow forever, and thus the price of oil would grow forever. Since the mid-2000s, Putin apparently takes less and less economic advice. He's not interested in speaking to advisors. He's interested in morning swims and weekend games of games of ice hockey and hunting. And people have not been able to explain to him that the emerging markets boom may have been driven by hot money, and that in the next year, with the end of with the tapering that's coming out of the US, with Russia growing at far less clip than the United States or even Britain, you could have a sudden withdrawal of hot cash back to the US. Putin's not been listening to any of this. And there's been a lot of fear from Russian officials that Putin may not understand that the oil price doesn't reflect demand. The oil price in the 21st century is financialized. It's an incredibly complicated series of bets, a lot of which are placed by computers, which no one can quite understand.
Robert.
Thank you. No, that was wonderful. Sorry, can I say? But, and I want to compliment what we've just heard. No, compliment it as well. What he also doesn't understand is the projection of hard power in this scenario. He has done an immense amount, we've discussed it on Monocle 24 before, the repristination, if I can say that, of the Russian order of battle. But there's a lot of heavy machinery there, main battle tanks, air defence systems and so forth. For repressing a very restive population, they're not much damn good for that. Now, this is part of the Putin gamble. I absolutely echo this. Where did he grow up? He grew up as a secret policeman or as a policeman in the FSB. He is not a military commander. And here, this is where the Hitler and Stalin analogy may be fair. Because what are you going to do if you put 100,000, say, Russian ground forces into Ukraine, Crimea, and across the eastern border? Because when you get ethnic fragmentation, which we're already seeing signs of in Crimea with the Tatars, they are not going to take this lying down. What are you going to do? Are you going to go in for bloody repression? If you have got such question marks over the domestic economy, you've got a huge domestic security problem, and you've got the Caucasus problem, and you have got fears about the migrant and the movement of Muslim and ethnic groups espousing the Islamic cause coming up from the stands. It's too many moving parts, is as Franz Joseph said to Mozart, too many notes, Mozart, too many notes in this piece of music. And I think that that is where he's going. That is why it is so scary. Nobody is in control.
Exactly. US Secretary of State Kerry has warned
that all options are on the table. He's mentioned possibility of economic sanctions, having some assets, Russian assets abroad frozen. He also has said that we could take a look at Russia's G8 status. Do you think any of these would actually make Putin more willing to cooperate?
I don't think G8 status will make Putin very frightened, because when Obama hosted the G8 in 2012, Putin couldn't even be bothered to go. And if you're going to expel Putin from a club, I think you should expel him from one he's interested in turning up to. Are all options on the table? Well, they're just not. And there's no military option on the table. Of course, there can't be. There's no serious option of economic sanctions on Russia on the table for the moment. And Putin has realised this because he's been looking very closely at American policy towards Syria. So we all know that Russia is supplying Syria with weapons. What we talk about less is that Russia is Syria's banker, and that the Russian state bank VTB, which is a very important bank in the Western economy these days as well, a very wealthy player in the London financial scene, is keeping Assad's economic lifeline going. If the United States had chosen to place economic sanctions on VTB, that would have been a serious blow, a missile strike into the Syrian financial system. And watching this and seeing nothing happen when the US has kind of given such grandiose statements, and I seem to remember John Kerry practically giving announcing an imminent war a few months ago, is why Putin is not frightened of any moves coming from Washington.
Let's continue with what else Secretary of State John Kerry has recently said. He spoke on the American television program Face the Nation on CBS, and here is what he said.
Well, it's an incredible act of aggression. It is really a stunning, willful choice by President Putin to invade another country. Russia is in violation of the sovereignty of Ukraine. Russia is in violation of its international obligations. Russia is in violation of its obligations under the UN Charter, under the Helsinki Final Act. It's a violation of its obligations under the 1994 Budapest Agreement. You just don't, in the 21st century, behave in 19th century fashion by invading another country on completely trumped-up pretext.
Robert, some are saying that the last part is a bit ironic, given the US experience in Iraq.
Yeah, you do in the 21st century, is the answer to Mr. Kerry. And that's why what he has said, frankly, if I can say it on Midori House, it's just so silly. And this is the thing that even the most neutral mind and commentator must be very critical of Mr. Kerry and Mr. Obama. It seems to me to be sublimely irrelevant what they're saying. That how does this address the actual situation? The real threat to Putin, as we know, is internal crumble, both in Ukraine itself, which is even a Ukrainian nationalist has said only in this day that it looks more and more like a regime built on sand, and also the difficulties that we see in Moscow itself. What is terribly worrying, and it's a point I began to make a bit earlier in our discussion, is that Europe must now decide what NATO stands for now that it is no longer threatened by the Warsaw Pact, but if it stands for something in collective security, now again is a moment when it has got to say something. It probably can't offer that much to Ukraine, but it must say something very loud, very clear about the Balts, and that's Estonia, Lithuania and Latvia. And it must also extend its pledges and make sure that that Turkey, which is very active in this area and is really on the front line in the Black Sea with all this, they face a possible refugee problem. They face a lot of subversion. It's very interesting, sorry, in parenthesis to add, how the Swedish academics have read this so much better than anybody else and really knew that this was coming on.
Very
they've known it almost for more than a year now. And this is what is worrying. And I'm very worrying about, you know, that Mr. Hague, flies into Kiev. The BBC flies into Kiev. Sorry to go on about this. And this is symbolic of something. It is no use grandstanding when you have to get into the granularity of this problem. Who is doing what to whom, and how can you stop an implosion? Because what you're going to get on the grand scale, favourite expression of mine, you're going to get a postmodern 21st century jacquerie. You're going to get an explosion of people just frustrated, the bitterness of the people on the streets, both in mainland Ukraine and in Crimea, is very worrying. And I think that that is the factor that has been miscalculated, is what the Twitter sphere is going to be saying about this, because that is where words do lead to actions. Not immediately very often, but medium to long term, yes. And that's why I think that Putin himself is courting disaster on this.
What Robert just said over there is interesting, that he said that Swedish academics actually knew a year ago already they had a better idea than pretty much anyone else of what would be coming up.
Why is it that
so many people in the West, when it comes to Western intelligence, in so many occasions they have consistently misread Putin's intentions?
I think a lot of it is about how think tanks and are funded. Think tanks have a really big influence over Western political elites and over Western debates. And think tanks, of course, are not publicly funded. They depend on money for grants. Who gives grants? Businesses give grants.
And governments.
So you get a vast overfocus on China. You get think tanks producing lots of very, very interesting work on East Asia.
I'd like to add a subset, sure, because I agree entirely. Very often, think tanks will give the answer that they think is acceptable to the government or the payer concerned.
Precisely.
And very often, you go to a think tank, and I'm talking to the prominent ones, three of which I'm a member of, but they actually tell me less than I know already when I go to a study day, because they've read the same literature that I've read. Very often, they read articles that I've written myself. And that is the problem. They take snapshots of today and yesterday. They are very poor on tomorrow.
We could continue talking about this for so long, but we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. I'll be back with Robert Fox and Ben Judah in a moment when we look at Benjamin Netanyahu's trip to America.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favorite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle Shop.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Robert Fox, defence editor of London's Evening Standard newspaper, and Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Let's turn now to the US, where Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is meeting with American President Barack Obama. Robert, there is a strained relationship between those two, isn't there?
I think there will be handshakes, there will be strained smiles, and I think that the strained relationship won't become all that much unstrained by this. There are colossal problems. At first, one could only stand by with admiration and perceive Mr. Kerry, who was, you know, busy, busy bee. He seemed to have taken something out of the Henry Kissinger shuttle playbook. He was rushing in and out and saying, look, we've got to get the peace process, if you're allowed to call it that, back on track. It is going to go absolutely nowhere for a lot of the reasons that we've been discussing hitherto. Ukraine is too big. Ukraine is also tangential, or not so tangential, to Syria. Syria is the main attraction. And the thing that the US and its allies, but particularly the US, has to be worried about is the potential implosion or the fragmentation of the fringes of, and possibly getting to the core of, Jordan and Lebanon. And that is why, you know, that Netanyahu is finding it hard to contain his hardliners on the settlement policy, the divisions of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, and so forth. Progress, do I see much coming out of this? No, not much at all.
Ben Jude, have you got any more hope?
I disagree. I think there's been a shift in American Israeli relations over the past year. And what I've noticed over the past 18 months is that the power of AIPAC in the United States used to reflect the unity of the American Jewish community. And over the past year, you've seen a disintegration of the unity of the American Jewish community. You have a majority of young Jews who actually agree with Mr. Obama that there should be partition of the land of Israel. You have the diminishing of its funding. You have big members of the community privately urging and exhorting Netanyahu to follow Obama's prescription. And AIPAC has had a string of failures over the past year on Syria and on Iran and on issues relating to settlement policy because the old unity of American Jews isn't there anymore. The most prominent American Jewish intellectuals sound very much like Barack Obama. And just before, perhaps when he should have been dealing with Ukraine, Obama gave this stunning and stunningly powerful interview to Jeffrey Goldberg about the dangers Israel faces, the dangers that the Jewish people as a whole face if Israel fails over the next 10, 15 years. And it was excellently done, like quoting the rabbinic sage Hillel. And I read the Israeli press every day, and there is big fear in Israel is that where do we stand if American Jews are no longer with us?
Exactly. How much worrying and how much fear is there in Israel about a potential anti-Israel boycott, like in general about a boycott movement, anti-Israel boycott movement?
It's definitely building. You have fear in what has happened in Israel over the past 15 years is this bizarre situation where middle-class, liberal, European-looking and American-looking Israelis can live as if, pretend as if the West Bank doesn't exist, because there are no costs of the occupation on them. And because they don't have to live in the strange theological settlements that exist on the other side of the Green Line, they can act as if it just doesn't exist at all. And there's growing fear that the boom in the Israeli economy and also the boom in Israeli society. Israel has counterintuitively become a much more liberal, exciting, drug-taking, hippie place over the past 10 years. I love it there. It's going to have economic sanctions placed on it.
And Robert Fox, you just really briefly, you still have something to say.
No, Ben, I absolutely am with you with all of that. But. The sensible end, the sensitive end, who have been sensitized by this, do understand that the whole question of whether they're going to get a two-state solution, which has been going since the Balfour Declaration, as to what they were going to end up with, see this disappearing if something is not done soon. My point is, I think there's a hard enough element in the settlement community and out on the right that they're not going to let, they have still got Netanyahu as their prisoner.
Unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much. Robert Fox, defence editor of London's Evening Standard newspaper, and Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Plenty still to come on the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our man in Budapest. We'll look back on the history of Acid House and we'll review the latest art from Toronto. But before we get started on all that, here is James Luckhurst with the world news headlines.
The Russian military has given Ukrainian forces in Crimea until 3 a.m. on Tuesday GMT to surrender or face an assault, according to Ukrainian defense sources. The head of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, Alexander Vitko, set the deadline and threatened an attack across Crimea. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov earlier said Russia was responding to ultra-nationalist threats. Analysts are warning that diplomatic and economic sanctions are the tools to hurt Russia as it risks being ostracized from the international community. The head of the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency, Yukiya Amano, says a landmark nuclear deal between Iran and six world powers is being implemented as planned. However, speaking of Vienna, he warned that much remained to be done to resolve all issues regarding Tehran's atomic activities. The first witness at Oscar Pistorius's murder trial has told the court that she heard blood-curdling screams from a woman followed by gunshots. Taking the stand after the Olympic and Paralympic star pleaded not guilty to murdering his girlfriend, model Reva Steenkamp, Michelle Berger testified she was woken up in the middle of the night by a woman shouting for help. Two Egyptian police officers have been sentenced to 10 years in prison for torturing an activist to death in 2010 in an incident that became one of the triggers for the uprising that toppled President Hosni Mubarak. Witnesses and rights groups said that 28-year-old Khaled Said died after police dragged him out of an internet cafe in the Mediterranean city valley Alexandria and beat him to death. And an Italian court has sentenced Beppe Grillo, leader of the anti-establishment five-star movement, to 4 months in prison for entering part of a sealed-off construction site during a protest against a high-speed train line in 2010. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James Luckhurst. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 22:35 in Moscow, 18:35 here in London, and 15:35 in Rio de Janeiro. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Budapest to speak with our man there, Adam Lebeau. Adam, welcome to the programme. Shall we start with the events in Ukraine? How are they being viewed in Hungary?
Well, with a lot of concern, and the concern and almost alarm is growing, firstly because Ukraine's right next door. And of course, there's very strong memories here of the Russian invasion in 1956. And there's also another element in the mix, which is that in the far western Ukraine, the borderlands with Hungary, there's 250,000 ethnic Hungarians who that part of Ukraine used to be part of Hungary until 1920. And many of those have recently taken out Hungarian citizenship. So there are considerable fears for their safety if it really starts getting nasty over there.
And when we look at what Hungarian politicians have been saying about the situation in Ukraine and the position these ethnic Hungarians are finding themselves in Ukraine, what have you heard?
Well, the interesting thing is what I haven't heard. The Prime Minister, Mr. Orban, has so far remained fairly silent on this whole issue, and this may be partly because Hungary recently signed a deal with Russia connected to the Paks nuclear power station on the Danube upriver from Budapest, which was quite controversial. It wasn't really properly debated in the parliament or in the country, and was and just kind of presented as a fait accompli, and has kind of locked Russia, locked Hungary into Moscow's energy embrace, and now suddenly that doesn't look like such a smart move. However, after sort of 3 or 4 days of not saying too much, today the Foreign Minister, Janos Martonyi, did make a very strong statement condemning what was happening in Ukraine and saying that you know, this has to stop and it's an assault on Ukrainian sovereignty. And it has a particular resonance because it was in an OSCE meeting, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, in 1994 that all the parties, including Russia, signed a memorandum, the 1994 memorandum on, you know, kind of respecting Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity. So Budapest is very, very closely watching what's going on.
Hungarian Foreign Minister also said that the country will fight any insults towards the Hungarian minority in Ukraine. What does that actually mean?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm sorry, I shouldn't really be laughing, but I mean, the idea of Hungary getting involved in some kind of military action against Ukraine or Russia is seems highly unlikely. I mean, this is for domestic consumption. The Hungarian government has made great play of bringing in the 5 million Hungarians who live in the countries around Hungary, Ukraine, Serbia, Slovenia, Slovakia, and Croatia, and Romania into, you know, the kind of the ethnic family, then, and Hungary's presenting itself as their protector. And that, you know, in itself, there's nothing wrong with that. But this is kind of slightly absurd rhetoric because I don't know what policy means Hungary has to protect the, you know, to take any kind of meaningful action. But having said that, I mean, at the moment, doesn't seem to be really any threat towards the Hungarians in, you know, in Ukraine, in the far west of Ukraine. I mean, western Ukraine, and we're talking about even further west than Lviv, has always been a bastion of Ukrainian independence. So I don't imagine that they're going to have too much problems at the moment.
What kind of preparations are taking place at the moment for a potential inflow of refugees to Hungary from Ukraine?
Well, the government has said that, if there was an inflow of refugees, it's conceivable that people could be flee from the east to the west and then from the west into Hungary, because we are a neighbouring country here on the border. So there's been talk that there's been preparations of medical facilities and obviously security issues here. Hungary has some experience of this because quite a lot of people came into Hungary from Croatia and Bosnia during the Yugoslav wars. So there is some experience, very recent, just 20 years ago, in dealing with large-scale influxes of refugees.
Besides Ukraine, another thing we should cover today when we talk about Hungary is the elections that are taking place in about a month on April the 6th. What is it looking like at the moment for different parties?
Well, it's looking like another victory for Fidesz, the ruling right-wing party. That's partly because of the disarray of the opposition. I mean, there's a five-party left, centre-left alliance called Unity, or Together, depending how you translate the word, which is standing on a joint list against the government, but they only reached an agreement earlier this year, so it's all very late in the day. And at the same time, there are some concerns about how transparent this election will be. There's recently a five-part, very detailed article by Kim Lane Shepele, who's a professor at Princeton University, dissecting the Hungarian electoral system and the way that the country and power here has been restructured under the government, that she says makes it almost impossible for the opposition to win. Of course, the government rejects those accusations and said it still remains a clear and functioning democracy. But there are some questions about that. And what's disturbing a lot of people is that the winners of the disarray on the left seem to be the far right. And the far right, one recent poll gave the far right Jobbik party 19%. Compared to just 20% for the socialists. So I could imagine that Jobbik might even become the second party in the country, which I think would cause a lot of concern.
Adam Lebor, Monocle's man in Budapest there. Thank you very much for this good speaking to you. Up next, we look at the history of one of the biggest youth movements in the UK since the 1960s, Acid House. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
What makes a good toy? Well, to find out, Monocle Films dropped in on the International Toy Fair in Nuremberg to discover the companies and the concepts with the X Factor.
Ultimately, who's a toy for? Just maybe the great resilience of the toy industry, all of the big sales and buzz and growth, isn't a simple matter of spoiled kids after all. Maybe it's a case of a previous generation's children, all grown up. Parents eyeing new products with cash in their pockets and a nostalgic glint in their eyes.
Big players, big business at the Nuremberg Toy Fair. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. The Summer of Love in 1967 saw the world's media identify and focus on the hippie phenomenon in North America. Well, the second Summer of Love may be a bit less known for many, but it did take a place a quarter of a century ago in the UK when Acid House arrived in the British clubs at the same time with a new drug, MDMA. This created the biggest youth phenomenon since the 1960s, and this is something that our next guest has looked at. Those events in the late 1980s that changed the cultural landscape forever. I'm joined now in the studio by author of the new book, Acid House, The True Story, Luke Bainbridge. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I just heard during the previous break you telling me that you didn't quite catch the beginning.
No, I didn't.
But you actually caught something towards the end.
Yeah, exactly, of the first explosion. But I think the thing with Acid House, that's very true, and I was talking to the DJ Terry Fowley about this, who features in the book, who was one of the founders of Boyzone. He says that the thing with Acid House is that everyone had their own little Road to Damascus moment. Everyone had their little epiphany. So, you know, it doesn't matter necessarily if you were there right at the start at Shoom or, you know, there's people who came into it 3-4 years later. I'm from Manchester, but people who came into it a bit later in, you know, smaller towns, they still had that same moment. And when they discovered Acid House, it's still a secret to them, but it's a secret that you want to pass on to everybody.
So when we talk about this second Summer of Love, how long did it actually last for? We're talking about 1988, 1989.
Yeah, we're probably talking about that initial period, the halcyon days, we're probably talking about 18 months to 2 years. But that's when it, and after that, it just exploded and the cat was out of the bag.
How do you remember it yourself?
I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because it was my formative years, and you want everything that happens during your formative years to be more important than the previous generation. So, but I'm sure everyone feels like that when they're 16. But it's with the passage of time, I think, that you can really start to see just how important the explosion of Acid House was. And, you know, it's the long-term effects and influence it's had.
So when we talk about what actually happened at the same time, Acid House arrived in the British clubs, but at the same time a new drug also arrived in British clubs, MDMA. How crucial was the drug when you look at that whole phenomenon now later on?
Acid House, it was absolutely crucial, but Acid House was the kind of perfect storm of the new drug, the new music and the new technology, which changed everything.
What do you mean by new technology?
Well, the technology for people to be able to make music in their bedrooms, which they weren't able to before. I mean, punk said, you know, all you need to know is 3 chords and then you can, you know, be in a band. But you still kind of needed someone's permission to go in a recording studio. You still had to find a recording studio. You still had to, you know, quite a lot of expense in making a record. And all of a sudden with Acid House, you can make it in your bedroom on a computer.
And when you think of the UK in 1988, 1989, and the general political climate, how much was this all about rebellion?
It wasn't necessarily anti-authority or anti-establishment. It was just pure hedonism at first. It wasn't a political movement at first, and it became political kind of by default, really, when the government and the authorities tried to clamp down on it. Then it became, slightly political because no generation of young people likes authorities and the government telling them what to do and trying to pass laws to outlaw their parties. So then it became political by default, but at first it was just pure hedonism.
It's now been a quarter of a century since Acid House first exploded in the UK. How much of that can you still see? How big an impact does it still have?
It's totally changed the cultural landscape of the country, I think. I mean, I just started going out to nightclubs just as Acid House hit, and pre-Acid House, a lot of the nightclubs were not very nice places to be. They were all awful, sort of slightly tacky places where you would go to, you know, perhaps get off with someone of the opposite sex, or, you know, perhaps even some people wanted to, you know, just fight people of the same sex. And Acid House turned nightclubs back into what they were supposed to be all along, which is places to go to dance. Then you also see, you know, the whole rise of now of EDM in America and stuff, and then that's how big that electronic dance music has become. It's the residences in Las Vegas that used to go to Elton John and Dolly Parton now go to Paul Oakenfold.
Well, we were trying to pick a good song to play after this interview, and I hope you like the song we picked. Let's stay with the theme of Luke's book. This is some classic acid house. The name, this is 808 State with Pacific 202. Do you like that
one? It's a great record, and good friends of mine from Manchester. It's a great record.
Oh, really? So this is from Northern England, this song. Thank you very much for the interview, Luke Bainbridge, author of Acid House, The True Story.
Thank you.
A bit of acid house even there for you. That was 808 State with Pacific 202. You're listening to Midori House. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are fast approaching the end of the programme, but before we go, time for our daily review segment where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema with our correspondents and contributors around the world. Today we talk art. And we head now to Toronto to speak with Murray White, art critic for the Toronto Star. Hello Murray and welcome to the programme. Shall we start with talking about a film that's called A Modest Livelihood? It's making its Ontario premiere.
Yes, why don't we? I mean, it's a fascinating film by a couple of First Nations artists, as we call them here, Aboriginal artists, Brian Youngin and Dwayne Linklater. And it's at the Art Gallery of Ontario. It's been there for a couple of months already. It was part of Documenta 14 recently. And the thing I think that's interesting about this is that it's a silent film. It's the pair of them, two people who really have enormous connections in the international world of contemporary art, off in the northern part of Alberta, which is a long way north in Canada, hunting for moose. And you know, there's sort of an absurdist element to this, but the artists don't intend it that way at all. They are First Nations people. This is part of their daily practice, much like art making is, and they wanted to sort of pull the curtain back on that aspect of their lives and how they are different from urban people, so to speak. But I think the thing that really sort of starts to resonate with this is that when they're off in this wilderness, the sort of heroicized wilderness, the way that we like to think of it, they're constantly sort of coming across pipelines and oil derricks, and these sorts of areas where, you know, vast resource wealth is being extracted from the landscape while they're pursuing their traditional lives. So Modest Livelihood has many layers to it, as you can imagine. I mean, they're hunting, they're subsistence hunting with the intention of eating the moose that they capture while billions of dollars are being pulled out of the ground all around them. So I can leave the listeners, I think, to connect those dots for themselves.
Definitely something to keep an eye on if anyone just gets a chance of seeing that. If we move on to what's going on at the Museum of Contemporary Canadian Art exhibition, Misled by Nature, Contemporary Art and the Baroque. What can you tell us about that?
Well, there's a fairly sort of intellectual framework to this, and there. I mean, we can talk about the Baroque as being, you know, certainly when it was a disparaging term in the 18th century, when it was sort of seen as an affront, I suppose, to sort of classical simplicity. Fast forward a couple hundred years later, and I think that you see a pretty strong trend in contemporary art towards more sort of handmade, more craft-driven things that are, you know, in a certain way, Baroque, much less so than, say, the conceptualism we've seen over the last few decades, which was quite spare. One thing to note about this, though, I think, is that the Museum of Contemporary Canadian Art is here in Toronto, which is a very dynamic place, while our National Gallery, which has actually organized the show, is in Ottawa. Ottawa not being anybody's idea of a good time. The National Gallery was quite smart in sort of developing some annex locations outside that national capital. And so you have selections from their collection here at MoCA, which are quite fascinating, and they are extremely Baroque. They're very visceral. There's an artist who some of your listeners might have heard of named David Altmed, who is known for, I mean, when I say visceral, I literally evisceration. So the piece that he has in the show is essentially what looked like two gargantuan Sasquatches, rather, splayed in a snowy glade with most of their entrails sort of placed out on the snow all around them. And I think, you know, you don't have to get too incredibly analytic to sort of get a sense of the idea of this is very much sort of a life and death kind of proposition about, I think, certainly Canadians' relationships with nature.
And just briefly, one more recommendation from you, exhibition called Casting the Negative.
Three very interesting Toronto artists here in this particular show at Daniel Ferrier Gallery. One, Ante Liu, who does remarkable castings from Casting the Negative, refers to the fact that the material he's casting from are, in fact, the things that we would throw away. It's the styrofoam packing that you might find for your television or your iMac or whatever the case might be. He takes them and kind of creates them in kind of remarkable forms. So you have these void objects being prioritized as art. Iris Hausler, who would dig holes in the earth with her hands and then fill them with a remarkable beeswax material and then allow them obviously to harden and sort of have this sort of incredibly organic sculpture created from this void, this accidental void. And Jennifer Rose Ciarino, who would use shadow from theoretical public sculptures in the shadows that they would cast in her studio floor, taking those shadows, laser cutting them into a piece of concrete and sort of allowing that organic shape to take place as well. So some really fascinating stuff here. A lot of it's sculptural right now, but I mean, it's choosing three is like choosing among the favorites among your children, so it was a very difficult thing to do.
Exactly. Thank you very much for this. That was Murray White, art critic for the Toronto Star. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. The show was produced by Daniel Ciocapelli, researched by Alexa Firmanish and James Bullock, and our studio manager was Bill Lutie. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. Thank you for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.